A prisoner on death row for a decade prepares to die, but then something goes wrong in the morning that's supposed to be his last. The lethal injection is not lethal. It seems familiar as various states, including Missouri, grapple with the ethics of administering capital punishment with untested drug cocktails. And it's the premise of Kansas City playwright Nathan Lewis Jackson's latest work, When I Come to Die. I'm Laura Spencer, and today on Central Standard, we'll have a conversation with the playwright and the director about this new production. That, plus music from one of the many folk performers descending on the city for the Folk Alliance Conference. And we'll take you out into the open air to paint. That's coming up right after this news. This is Central Standard. I'm Laura Spencer. In recent months, there have been lots of stories about the death penalty. There's currently a nationwide shortage of the drugs used most often in lethal injections, and some states have turned to an untested mix of drugs. These have led to painful deaths and lawsuits from death row inmates. You'd think that writing a play about death row inmates would put Nathan Lewis Jackson in the middle of this debate, but Jackson says his play is not political. It doesn't take sides. Instead, he says the work grew out of a fascination with time, knowing how much time you have left until you don't. Today, we discuss Jackson's new play at the Kansas City Repertory Theater called When I Come to Die. Joining us today, playwright Nathan Lewis Jackson. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Also, Kyle Hatley, the Rep's Associate Artistic Director, who's also directing the production. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the play opens after death row inmate Damon Robinson has survived what's intended to be a lethal injection. He calls it a fluke, and others call it a miracle, and he's faced with a second chance. Let's listen to a clip when Father Adrian Krause, played by Kevin Cristaldi, and he's a prison chaplain, meets with Damon, played by Will Cobbs.
I thought the most important thing was doing something with the time you had left. But none of that matters when you tell me I'm just going to die again.
David, you were always going to die. We're all going to die. That's never going to change. What has changed is how you're living your life.
So that's a clip from When I Come to Die, and we have the playwright and the director here with us today from the Kansas City Repertory Theater. Nathan, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the play is focused on two men on death row, and yet it's not. You've said it's not about the death penalty. Could you talk a little bit about kind of navigating that?
Well, when I originally came up with the idea, it was more about, as you said, the fascination with time. And when you are given more time, or when these guys are probably the only people that we know who know when their day is. Most of us go about our day and we assume we're going to wake up in the morning. These guys know the day they're going to die. And when that changes, or when your life is turned to a different direction and now you have to figure out what you have to do with your life, how does that affect your journey? And it's for Damon, but it's also hopefully for all of us to wonder when you have that time, what do you do with it?
And Kyle, you describe the play as not just about a prison of solid walls. It's about a prison of one man's mistakes. And could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just dovetailing off what Nathan just said, I mean, like when the impossible happens and you wake up from what was originally your death penalty time, date and time, and you're left with the same feelings you had before that established time, the character laments to to the priest that he can't go back to just waiting, because he'll go crazy. And that's the thing, is that he had already prepared himself to die, to let go. And then he wakes up in the cell, as he says, just to, why would he want to survive just to rot in a cell again, or to wait for another scheduled death? And so he lives with these thoughts of what his life was rather than what his life might be. Because if you know not only the date and the hour, but also the second that first injection comes in, then you begin to essentially count down your time, but you focus on that, your end, as opposed to what life might mean to you in that moment. And so his first, to me, it feels as though his first injection that he survived, those days leading up to that, he had nothing to live with but what he had done and the family that had abandoned him, and the people that were surrounding him that he can't have any contact with. And now in this sort of reprieve, in this almost the second chance in a way, he could go crazy just sitting there waiting again, or wallowing in these thoughts of what he has done and therefore who he is. But in his encounters or in his meetings with the priest, he begins to discover that there's something kicking in him. There's something stirring in him. He puts it as he's leaping out of his skin and he doesn't know why. And he causes a prison riot. So he's acting out in this way that he can't define quite yet. And over his conversations with the priest, in by no means religious conversations, but just in terms of like talking about sports, talking about life, talking about all of these different things, he begins to understand what matters to him and how he might be able to affect some kind of change, even if he's in a cell 23 hours a day, how he might affect change in his own mind, how he might affect change in those that he comes in contact with. And they're small, they're microscopic, but they add up, these potential moments that he can make contact with other people.
Nathan, you grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, and studied at K-State and then went on to study at Juilliard. But I'd read that it was through competitive speech and debate at K-State that you first started playwriting. And in particular, this piece, When I Come to Die, started as a forensics piece.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. We were at K-State University, and it was actually a forensics piece for a good friend of mine. I had written some pieces for myself and some of my teammates. Sometimes it's hard to find a new piece or a piece that fits your voice. So I don't know where I came up with the idea originally. I think it was just, a matter of I've always been fascinated just with the idea of time. And it was just a quick 10-minute monologue. And eventually that slowly became – well, it's that the play itself was actually commissioned by Lincoln Center out of New York. And when they commissioned that, this 10-minute piece that I'd written years ago that had kind of been burning in my brain just seemed like the right thing to turn into a larger piece.
Do you think that experience with forensics kind of shaped your dialogue? It seems like with the play has a lot of the kind of snappy dialogue and really, really very authentic voices.
I think so. I mean, we could probably use all the rest of this time to talk about how speech shaped me, but in that particular regard, it definitely affected at least that piece. The dialogue is was big here because these are characters that I do connect to. These are characters who some of the guys are based off the people I've worked with and family members who had been in and out of the system. At the same time, they are not me. Well, you could argue other plays that I've written, these characters are taken from a piece of my soul. Some of these characters took a little bit more pulling and a little bit more studying to make sure that they felt authentic. And that also affected the dialogue. The dialogue was very important to make that sound natural and at the same time entertaining to watch. And I think you could argue that maybe, going every weekend performing these pieces and seeing how people react to them helped get an early start on that.
When you talked about research, some of this is based on family members. And I know that the two of you in shaping the production here in Kansas City visited the Kansas Correctional Facility in Lansing. And could you talk about what that experience was like and how that maybe informed this production here?
Yes. Well, I'd been there before, again, having family members who had been in the system. And I'd also visited the corrections facility in Hutchinson, Kansas, as well. This one was different. This was a minimum security, and we actually were allowed to go to one of the meetings, a Reaching Out From Within program, where these prisoners meet. I think it's weekly they meet, and we actually got a chance to sit down and talk to these guys, which a lot of the visits, that's not allowed. We do tour the inside of the facility and see how things operate and talk to the wardens. But to really get a chance to speak to the prisoners is a rare thing. The inmates is a rare thing. And it was great to sit down and talk to these guys. And what was really interesting on, the last particular meeting, the first meeting, was that I didn't know what any of these guys did. I didn't know that. And towards the end of the meeting, they would tell us, you could see, what their crime slowly leaked out, whether just in random conversation or as we sit down more, they'd say what they did. But by then, we'd already got to meet these guys, and it was great to get to sit down and understand who these people are aside from this one act that they did. And that was, I thought, was fantastic and really gave me a closer connection to these guys.
Which is actually like one of the things that makes When I Come to Die so like it's a masterful idea that Nathan almost withholds the information about the two death row inmates in the show. He withholds information about what they did until just like at the very end, and it's a masterful choice in terms of it allows us not to define them based on their crime, but rather sort of get to know them, and then we understand that collision of what they've done and who they might have been and possibly who they still might be. So it's a pretty challenging experience, actually.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Laura Spencer. Our guests are playwright Nathan Lewis Jackson and the Reps Associate Artistic Director Kyle Hatley. We're talking about the Reps' current production of When I Come to Die. And you both mentioned the two inmates, and we've talked about Damon, but there's also Roach, who is his cellmate right next door. And there's a very interesting relationship between the two. In the beginning of the play, it seems like there's sort of some anger on Damon's part, but they have they have a camaraderie. And could you talk a little bit about kind of developing their relationship?
That's a weird one. It was the best I can say about the best I can say about that would probably be that relationship is mirrored from a relationship that I had when I worked at the barbecue restaurant with a dishwasher. And every day I'd come in and the dishwasher would come in and I was more Damon and the dishwasher was more Roach. And some of our dynamics of him talking and me being annoyed by him talking. But at the same time, if he didn't show up that day, it was kind of like, oh, man, where's he at? Type of thing. I didn't notice that we had kind of developed a relationship. I didn't think you could develop a relationship with someone who annoyed you in such a great relationship. It's almost like I needed that constant, I don't know, yip-yap on the side of my head every day. I don't know if it was just to fill the empty space at times, to get through the day. But a lot of that is mirrored off our relationship. I mean, he wasn't made the same choices that Roach made, and I didn't make the same choices that Dane made. We were working at a barbecue restaurant, but it was still some of the same dynamics. So when it came to writing the play, that relationship was very fun and very natural to put on the page.
I wanted to bring up letters. They play a large role in the story, and Damon keeps hundreds of letters that he's written to his family. They've been returned unopened and in six shoe boxes under his bed. Let's listen to a clip.
Dear Mom, how are you? I'm just hanging in there, but I ain't gonna lie. It's been hard. Guess I've been here for almost a year, but it feels like longer. You're standing in the doorway with your arms out. When I get to you, I give you a big hug. You know I'm safe. It feels so real that I hate to wake up. Because when I wake up, I'm in this cell. But I am glad I get to see you, even if it's only in my dreams. Love, your son, Damon.
And again, that's Damon, a prison inmate in When I Come to Die, and he's reading a letter, and he shuffles through his shoeboxes, and he's been in prison for 10 years, but this is a letter that he wrote in his first year, and he describes these letters as his contact, as this human connection, because he doesn't have much of a relationship with his family outside of the prison. And how did you come up with the idea of letters as this kind of narrative device?
I think it's always an easy route for a writer, because we're writers and we like to write, but when you're, again, in that cell for 23 hours a day, there's not a lot that you can do. And writing is one of the big things that the guys do, whether it be personal, just things they're going to keep for themselves, a journal, whether it be a lot of them actually do try to write novels or poetry, and then some just write letters to family. We got lots of letters from my uncle when I was growing up, and that was one. And that was also a way that he could have a connection to the outside, which is very important for these guys who don't have that connection, to feel like you're still connected to anything outside of these walls.
And Roach, the inmate in the cell next door, has an important letter, his last letter that mm-hmm. he's reworking and working throughout the end of the play.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Again, just kind of the same connection, but also when I was doing the research, one thing that I found interesting on the websites was you can always read these guys' last words, which was weird.
It's haunting. Yeah.
Very haunting. Very haunting. And they vary from short to long, from angry to a lot of the guys have come to peace. It just depends. But all of these, at least on the Texas website, I know. I think a couple of those, Texas being the leader in lethal and being the leader in executions, has a lot of information on their website, and those letters are one thing that you can look at.
And the play was originally set in Texas, and mm-hmm. then you decided to switch it to Indiana. And could you talk a little bit about that?
It was a weird decision we made, at least originally. And one, because I like to write about Kansas and everything that was Kansas, but the way the Kansas death row unit is set up didn't work for us as well. Same with Texas. Indiana seemed to be where it worked the best, at least for our play, that we can get people in and out of cells and try to make it look as realistic as possible. And when you're talking about these units, I mean, you're talking about these walls, to do a play on Kansas death row or do a play on Indiana death row or Texas death row, these prison walls, inside these walls, it's a totally different world. So it's not necessarily regional. It's not like you're going to find that the Kansas prisons mirror Kansas. It's a totally different wall. It's all shut off. They're more like each other than they are like the city they're in, if you know what I'm saying. So we picked where the play took place based off of what would give us the most realistic feel on stage.
Well, Nathan, you're now the resident playwright at the Kansas City Rep, and I'm just curious for both of you, Kyle and Nathan, what this experience has been like. Having a playwright here from the beginning of the process to the completion, and also Nathan, you as a playwright having your play staged and being very involved with casting and the whole process.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like the first play of his that I read, Brokeology, was one of the most moving first reads I've ever had, and I had a passionate reaction to it, and it became an instant fan. And I tell Nathan this often. Like I would direct anything he writes. I'm fascinated with how he sees the world. I'm fascinated with the characters that he creates, and the teeth that even the funniest moments of his play can still have. And it's really nice. Nathan is incredibly busy, whether it's working on the TV shows that he's writing for or developing a new play somewhere else in the country, against the schedule of producing 7 or 8 shows a year at the Rep. We get fortunate on how we can actually get together before this residency and really just sort of depend on phone calls, et cetera. But now we actually share an office space, so we can just turn our swivel chairs and annoy each other. So I'm not sure which one's Roach. I'm pretty sure I'm Roach and he's Damon. But it's nice to have him around, obviously, to have a talent like that at the Rep and to have a voice like this in the place where you grew up. It's of course having that kind of voice close to or in close proximity to the work that he's also written. It's the magnitude that has in terms of inspiration for the actors, for the designers, for me, for the audience, even knowing that Nathan is probably in the house somewhere. Even just the other night on Tuesday night, we had a preview walking out, and Nathan couldn't move 5 steps without being bombarded by our audience members, who have this unique opportunity to meet Nathan and to have conversations with him. So it's incredibly helpful. And plus, Nathan's very active in our education outreach program here at the Rep as well, which is also an incredible inspiration to those we're reaching out to and connecting with. But also it's fun to just sort of bat around ideas and listen to the things he's conjuring for his next play. It's just being that close to that creative energy that is Nathan Jackson is hilarious, but it's also incredibly charging. It's electric. So it's really great. It's a great opportunity for us, and we're happy to have him home.
Thanks, sir.
Again, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Laura Spencer. Our guests are playwright Nathan Lewis Jackson and the Rep's Associate Artistic Director, Kyle Hatley. We're talking about the Rep's production of When I Come to Die. Do you have questions about the play or the writing process. You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Kyle, you mentioned previews, and I attended a preview last night, and you let the audience know that previews are part of the process, that you're learning and refining from it. I wonder if you could talk about if the previews have kind of shaped the final product. If, you know, the opening night is technically Friday night, you know, how that process works.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the traditional rehearsal process at the Rep starts with three weeks in, well, 2.5, almost 3 weeks in the room, in a rehearsal room with just taped lines and some objects that sort of stand in for what our set will be. And, you know, even stand in props and stuff like that. And then we move into a tech rehearsal process, which is the slow and arduous long hours, 12-hour days, where we spend 5-6 days making sure that every lighting cue, every sound cue, every costume piece, every prop, every element of the theater is syncing up with the work we've done in the room, all the while making sure that we're really centering in on what makes this play work and how we can best realize it, especially having the playwright here. The playwright here in rehearsals with us and around us, it's my mission as the director and as the associate artistic director to be sure that we realize his play as perfectly as possible, so that if there are changes along the way that he might see or that he might want to make, we have the opportunity to do that in front of a live audience, which is the best way to identify if a play is working and if it's not, or if the direction is working or if it's not. So we have 6 previews where we get to spend 5 hours a day rehearsing, take a meal break, and then show back up and essentially have an invited dress rehearsal with an audience. The actors get to get a feel for how the audience interacts with their work. And Nathan and I get to sort of sit back and feel out. You can tell a whole crowd of people, they don't lie. If suddenly everyone's putting leaning their head into their wrapped up fist, then something's probably moving a little too slow. But if people are leaning in, or if you're hearing audible gasps, I try to identify night to night how it's working, how it's not. It's a very attractive science, I think, actually, and it makes making plays so much more challenging than you might expect, but also so much more fun. I mean, it's our job to make sure that the audience and the story come as close together without any of us ever getting in the way and trying to erase all those fingerprints as best we can. And that's my favorite part of the process, the preview process, because it's kind of like educated guesswork. Because an audience can vary from night to night. You know, the weather can change the entire mood of an audience. If there's a big concert going on and traffic is slow getting to the theater, that could change the mood of an audience. So you have to take those kind of things into account as well. It's a very human process, and so I dig it.
Nathan, would you like to add anything about the process? And
I'll just say, for me as a playwright, if you come to the show, you're watching the show, not me. But if you were to watch me, I am watching. A lot of the times I'm watching the audience because I've already seen the play a couple times. So I am really curious to how people are reacting. And there are certain moments that I'm curious to how my audience will react to that. So a lot of the times during specific moments of the play, even this play, I'm thinking about specific moments. If you look at me, I've kind of got my head turned and I'm like, here we go. Let's see. The moment happens. I'm like, okay, what's happening? Great. Okay. And I'm listening for the gasps, or I'm listening. If there's a moment where I'm like, is this too slow? Just as Kyle was explaining, I'm seeing what kind of energy the audience is giving back out. And that's why the preview process is awesome for me.
Well, it's interesting because I think in a theater you can sort of tell the audience reaction if there's lots of coughing or if people are quiet, or there is sort of this communal, the group experience. And so it's interesting.
It's absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a process of deduction, really.
Yeah.
Well, there's a surprising amount of humor. And, you know, I think that if you think of Death Penalty, Prisoners on Death Row, I don't think you automatically assume that there's going to be humor, but there's quite a bit in this play. And could you, especially I think with the relationship between Damon and the father, and could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, with the humor, I've always said to myself, I can never I'll probably never write a play that is completely serious or completely funny. I just never have had too many moments in my life. I don't think I've had two hours of my life that have been completely funny or completely dramatic. It always is a fine mix of the two, as well as the fact that sometimes the more dramatic moments or the points that we're really trying to hit home, sometimes are easy to swallow if you wrap them in a little humor. And I think that always works. And sometimes it's harder to get through if you can't like take a break and just kind of take a breath. And the humor is not, it's never like a, you know, we're not talking about slapstick, farcical type of humor here. It's just a matter of the situation is just sometimes funny. It's just someone will say something that is just, it just happens to be funny. And you roll with it. And then after it's funny, you let it go. And then you can get back on the serious issues. But it happens all the time. And maybe it just happens in my life, but I think it happens to a lot of people. So it's something that just naturally happens, as well as something that we can use for our benefit.
Well, and you talk about kind of observing the audience, and I'm just wondering if there are any moments that have struck the audience as humorous that you maybe didn't anticipate. Have things like that come up?
Oh, yeah. I don't want to give anything away, but there's a couple of lines. I mean, some of the bigger stuff is probably between Roach and Damon. And there are some moments I just didn't think it was that funny. And the audience thinks it's hilarious, certain lines. There's also a line, we'll talk about it later, Kyle. There's a line that I think is hilarious, and people just aren't laughing. Not like they don't have to laugh.
I think I know
but
which
I thought
one
it was
about.
Just funny. It was so funny. But nobody's laughing. Every once in a while you get those lines too, so you get a little bit of both. So.
We had a question from Beth in an email, and she asked if are there any plans to perform this production in jails? Is that something that you've considered, kind of taking it on the road?
I think there's been talk of it. I mean, I can't say that there are solid plans, but I know that's been discussed, especially with the reaching out within a group that we've kind of hooked up with. That's been talked, and I think who was it? Old professor Marsha Norman, who after she wrote Night Mother, I think she wrote another play. I can't think of the name of the play now. Hopefully Marsha's not listening and going to shoot me, but I can't think of it. But it was about a prison. And she told me after I wrote this, she said, you know that when you write a play about prison, a lot of times they end up getting performed in prison. So though there are no plans for that, it would not be unlikely that that could happen.
Okay. Kyle, did you want to?
I think it's. I think it would be a really fascinating idea. I would love to. I'd love to see this play somehow make itself work in that. Even if it was just a reading, even if we could set something like that up, I think that would be, incredibly moving and incredible. I'd be interested for really the conversation afterwards. I think is what I would be most tuned into if we did something like that. I think it would be a fascinating mm-hmm. conversation. But it's also like there's so much about this play that teaches an audience or illuminates some things that we would never know about prison and about how it's almost like surviving in prison. The way you describe how what a contact is in prison and how there is this need to connect in some way, almost extraordinarily metaphorically through a physical object of some kind, because there is such a severe lack of touch and human touch and human connection in that regard. These two guys, Roach and Damon, are in a cell right next to each other. They can hear each other all day long, but they can't even see each other. And the way they even have to interact in terms of their conversation is broken up by this wall, which creates a chasm or a void between them. So it's just interesting to like take that atmosphere that our audience, that any of us that are making the story, have to learn and sort of we've never known this, and then bring that story to a place where that's daily life. I'd be curious to know. I'd be curious to know how that would go over, and I think it would be incredibly moving, and I think it would reflect really accurately on what it means to sort of be locked up all day long.
Well, it's a small cast of When I Come to Die, only five people. But in several scenes, including the riot scene that you mentioned earlier, Kyle, you hear the voices of the other inmates. And how did you kind of come? I mean, were they cast members in that you recorded, or what was that process of recording the sounds of
The prison riot specifically? Mm-hmm. That's actually a relatively funny story. Well, there's a moment in the play where there's where Damon conjures a prison riot. And we needed to make that sound full and sort of realistic. And so we were I was talking to the sound designer, Joseph Concha, about how we might do that. And it just occurred to me that we have a shop where we build the sets, and we have a lot of guys that work in that shop that carry heavy tools. And you know what I mean? That there are a lot of there. So it just felt like the obvious place to go. So we literally spent about 45 minutes or an hour in the shop just causing a prison riot with hammers and things to bang on and all these guys yelling and screaming and improvising. And it was kind of fascinating to do that with guys who are responsible for building our beautiful sets and props and all the elements that make our shows work, but rarely are they ever sort of seen or acknowledged in a way. And we have one of the best shops in the country. So it's fun when we actually have these kind of moments and opportunities to be like, hey guys, do you want to be in the play? and they had the best time. We have some videos of it, but some of the improvising is a little explicit, so it's hard to share it.
So they make a cameo in the prison, yeah. Prison riot.
I can hear myself yelling in it too, actually. Yes.
Well, you all were talking about reaction, and Nathan, the play was originally presented in New York. And how was it received in New York, where, as I understand it, there is no death penalty, whereas in this part of the country, there's more of a familiarity with that as something with, you know, as in Missouri, there's an execution scheduled, you know, coming up later this month.
Yeah, I think it. I mean, in New York, it was received well. In New York, it was received well. I think what you, I'll just say, because I know it was a very good friend of mine who went to see the show. And after the show, he came to me and said, I didn't like the play. I didn't like it, but I loved it. I'm glad you showed it to me. It was one of those things of, at times, you know, it is about the death penalty. And it's not a happy play. You know, it's not something it's like almost there. Yeah, we'll just say it doesn't always leave you possibly feeling great after the show like other shows will. But he and I think many others seem to get hopefully what was being said and seem to connect and seem to relate that back to their lives, which is always great for a playwright. And I think here you might get more of that because we are dealing, I think, on both sides. And now, and at the time when we were in New York, these issues with the death penalty, issues with lethal injection were not happening. So now there are actually issues with one of the injections is not being sold or made anymore, as well as it has been a botched execution. It's other things that have happened that made this possibly more relevant. So we'll see what kind of we get a different reaction here than we will there.
On the other hand, like I would enthusiastically argue that it is, it does, I don't think it really does leave you with a sad feeling because there's triumph in the end. I'm not going to give it away, but there's, I think that's what's so beautiful and poetic about Nathan's work, specifically in this play, is how it can take a subject like this and point at the celebration of life in a way that you might not expect, even from the very beginning of the play and as you track through it, that by the end, I don't think you see – if I'm doing my job right, then I don't think you see that hook until just the end.
Yeah, we talked earlier about kind of the second chance and what Damon does with a second chance. So I think if you talk to audience members, I'd be curious to see if some of them kind of left feeling uplifted or some of them. I would say that people probably had different responses to the end of the play. Mm-hmm. Well, Damon, as part of your three-year residency at the Rep, you're charged with writing and developing two new plays. And I'm just curious, what themes or topics you're kind of, looking at exploring right now.
Oh, I'm looking at everything. I'll say this because, it's always weird for a playwright because you don't want to, you want to have all that energy build up inside of you. I don't like to talk too much about it. But some of the things that are going on nowadays since I've moved back we'll just say some of the things in the news and some of the things going on. Moving back, I'll just say a lot of things are going on in the news right now. This whole thing going on in Florida, and we say Florida, but it's going on all over the country with the teams who are being gunned down. It's very off-putting to me, especially raising two children, both African-American children. I wonder what that means. My mother growing up said that her mother had to teach him and raise him a different way, and I hope that we're past that. And maybe we're not. Maybe we have to tell my child to be careful when he wears a hoodie or careful when he plays music too loud. And I thought we were way past that, but maybe that's not the case. So some of that stuff moves me, and when something moves me and I get passionate about it, I feel as if I need to write about it. Now, that what direction we go, hey, we'll see when the play is finished. But
well, how has your writing process changed if you're coming into the rep and you're here with Kyle Hatley and Eric Rosen? I mean, is it more, do you feel like your writing process has changed a little bit and more collaborative, or do you still need that time away alone?
Well, you always have to have time away, but the great thing about being here is being able to write, or every day, every other day, excuse me, whenever I come in, I get to be around the arts. I get to be around artistic, creative people. And who you are around, what music you listen to, your environment tends to affect your writing. So if I'm around a bunch of creative people and we're laughing, we're having a good time, and I can bounce ideas off of Kyle, great. And that has been able to help me a lot. And then when I need the time alone, I can write somewhere else.
I'd like to thank our guests from the Kansas City Repertory Theater, Nathan Lewis Jackson. You just heard from him. He's the resident playwright, and Kyle Hatley, Associate Artistic Director. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Jackson's play, When I Come to Die, directed by Hatley, runs through March 16th at Copaican Stage in downtown Kansas City. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, a conversation with Chuck Mead. The Grammy-nominated musician and songwriter returns to Kansas City and his hometown of Lawrence this weekend. Also, we'll tag along with some artists who paint outdoors, even when it's below freezing. Central Standard returns in just a moment.